Good morning. This is Chef Elena Alexander, and I'm on the phone with Chef Franco. She and I were just recently working together, and I thought she'd be a great interview for this podcast. As per usual, it's just a lovely kind of conversation about food, food history, and our impacts of food on culture and vice versa. So, Chef Franco, give us a little bit of your background, full name, where'd you grow up?
Good morning. My name is Chef Linda Franco. I grew up on the south side of Chicago. I come back from a Southern and Caribbean style cooking background. My mom being from the South and my dad being from South America, Georgetown, Guyana. I've been interested in cooking since I was 16, started in high school in a culinary arts program that was provided at my high school. And from there, got great tutelage under one of my instructors, continued on to culinary arts school as far as college, and then went to undergrad school to get my BA in hospitality management. So that's pretty much my background there.
Awesome. It sounds real familiar. We have pretty much a similar kind of pathway. Except for I didn't get culinary in high school. That happened all after.
Okay.
So since you have a American background and a non-American background throughout the family, were there two different styles of cooking when you were growing up, like cousin so-and-so did straight Southern and the other set on the other side of the tree did something completely different?
Absolutely. Especially around the holidays for me. Me and my sisters, because I have three sisters, so I'm the oldest, we had two different sides of the families to attend when it was the holidays. So on the Southern American side, you would have your traditional way of making the greens and the macaroni and the sweet potatoes. But when you get to the Caribbean side, on my dad's side, everything was the same but tasted different. We still had greens and macaroni and sweet potatoes and ham, but the way they did it had different herbs and had different spices incorporated to it. So the Christmases and the holidays and Thanksgiving was never the same, because we always got something different with each person's house that we went to. So it was interesting growing up where, and traditionally we will, let's say traditionally, a lot of Southern people make chitlins for Christmas. Well, on my dad's side, they make a dish called pepper pot with oxtails. And it's a fabulous dish that has so many herbs and spices incorporated into it that you don't even need to refrigerate it.
Oh, wow.
Right. And it can stay out. You don't need to refrigerate it. The only rule is to keep the bacteria that's already inside of it, is to use the same constant spoon or utensil that you started out with, or use a freshly cleaned, wiped down, dried, sanitized one every time you go and get some more out of the pot. Once you cross-contaminate, use like one, the spoon to get dressing and then turn around and use it to get pepper pot, you have to refrigerate it after that, because there's a certain amount of bacteria. It's a good bacteria that my dad explained to me that I really can't quite remember. Mm-hmm. But it's a bacteria that holds it at a preserved state outside of refrigeration. And once you cross it with another utensil, you have to refrigerate after that. So growing up, that was like a big thing. Do not mix the spoons for the pepper pot. You know, so if you did, you're in trouble, because that was one less thing that had to go back into the refrigerator.
Wow, really kind of cool. So
yeah.
It's kind of like refrigerator pickles versus, you know, a canned pickle kind of thing.
Yeah, it really is. And it's a fabulous dish. They make a special bread to go with it. And the main thing you want is the sauce, the gravy that's provided with it, and it's a great dish. Something that I haven't attempted to try to cook yet, but I let the aunts and the uncles continue to do it until it's my turn, because you want to get it as you want to just keep getting the wonderful flavor. And if I mess it up, I'm going to be mad at myself. because you mess up Peppa Pot, there's no coming back from it. Trust me. So I just continue to enjoy my family making it from their cultural side. Whereas on the southern side, oxtails is made completely different. You know, so growing up, it was like I can always get a variety with the same content.
Cool, very cool. So since you're the oldest of a group of kids, are you the oldest in your generation? Have they passed the torch on to you as you're like the new matriarch yet?
I am not. I have a lot of older cousins. Actually, we're all within the same like checkbox. We're all between that checkbox of 30 to 35. But I'm the only cook in the family. I'm the only one that cooks. I'm the chef of the family. So I am commissioned to do things. They haven't quite passed the torch because on the Caribbean side, right up until my grandmother, who was 90, passed, she cooked every single big meal. So that torch doesn't automatically go to the next generation of the grand. It goes to the next generation of the parents. Then the parents pass it along. And we still have people like my dad and my aunts who are still in the kitchen cooking and really not allowing my generation in the kitchen to do anything because for them on that side, that's what they do. Until the day that they die, they're in the kitchen. Whereas on my American side, I've been cooking Thanksgiving dinner, Christmas dinner by myself since I was 15. And they're all too happy to pass the torch once they see that you've got it. Like, literally, I was in the kitchen with Granny and Grandma and Great-Grandma and Mom cooking, and by the time I was 15, I was making two or three dishes by myself. So they're happy to pass the torch on the American side. It's like, yes, you know, but on the Caribbean side, they want to hold on to it for as long as they want, as long as they can, because it's something about that satisfaction of constantly being able to give your family the thing that they can do best. You know, each person on my dad's side, they all special at one of the many dishes that we love to eat. So it's in them to say, I'm going to keep going until y'all have to literally take me out of my hospital bed to make this dish. So it's harder on the Caribbean side, but it's a lot easier on the American side.
Okay, cool. What is your earliest food memory?
My earliest food memory, I would say, on my American side, was with my great-grandma. I can remember sitting on an Easter Sunday, and I can remember sitting in the kitchen, and just we had this old time, it was this old rickety metal chair that everybody sat in, and it was kind of like a step chair, and I was sitting in that chair.
I know what you mean. We had those.
Yeah, chairs. And you pull it out, and it's got like three stairs for you to step up on. And I can remember sitting in Easter, watching my great-grandmother and my mother and my grandmother in the kitchen getting all the cakes and the pies and, you know, the Easter dinner together. And I'm looking like, wow. And for a child that young, it was just basically magic. Because you went to sleep, it wasn't there. You woke up, it was there. So for me, these women were magic. It was like all this food that I love to eat, it is magically here. And I had been about 7 or 8, and I realized, like, man, I want to be in here when they do this stuff. I want to see, like, from beginning to end. And slowly and surely, the more I showed interest, the more they started entering me into the kitchen. On my dad's side, that took longer. Because on the Caribbean side, kids are not allowed in the kitchen. When they're cooking, they're cooking. And my earliest memory with watching wasn't until I was about 11 or 12. And it was a barbecue, and I was going through my grandmother's kitchen, and she stopped me, and she's like, you're the first one in here, so you're going to help me. And that's when I started helping her and seeing all that it took to eat all of the wonderful Caribbean dishes that I love to eat. And how much work goes into that. So that really fueled me at 7 to learn more of the Southern style of cooking. And then by the time I was 11 and 12, seeing how great and how much work it took to make Caribbean food, even fueled me more. There's just some dishes that I would not attempt to make because I know I can make them, but coming from the heart and soul of the way that my grandmothers make, because both my grandmothers passed within 9 months of each other, and okay. it's hard for me to make some of the dishes that they made that were so traditional, that had so much love put into them, because mm-hmm. I kind of want to hold on to that flavor, that memory flavor of how mm-hmm. they did it. You know, okay. so I'll just leave it to someone else and, you know, just kind of just, you know, take a seat back. But I've slowly been attempting to pull off some of the things that my grandmothers have done. And I've been getting, you know, thumbs up from the family by me being a chef. So everyone looks to me and calling me. And it's like, go from your heart. That's my number one thing. Go from your heart when you're cooking.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So the Afro-Caribbean, the Southern Afro-American background, do you think that added to your desire to become a chef? What actually made you take that leap from high school to professional cooking?
You know, it was just something, you know how you do something and it's just natural. It was just a natural transition. There was no question. There was no contemplating it. There is no, well, what else do I want to be? When I took it in high school, that's what I knew I wanted to be. There was no other desire. There was no other interest. I locked on it, and that was, I was like a pit bull on a steak. There was nothing else that could deter me on a profession other than cooking. So it was more of a natural transition when it came to looking for colleges to go to. And I didn't know much, you know, when I was in high school, a lot of schools did not have culinary as a major for cooking, maybe for hospitality and concierge and things like that, but not for getting in the kitchen and learning, because at that time, most professional chefs were working in family kitchens and earning their way up. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of a small pool for me to choose to go to. But like I said, I had a great mentor. His name was Mr. Ron Martin. I wish I could find him to this day because he was such a huge influence. He was my godfather of culinary because he mentored me, counseled me, and geared me to where I needed to be, to where I am today. And that's when I attended Washburn, because not only did he attend there, he was once an instructor there. And Washburn for me, maybe not for a lot, back when I went, it was like the real world kitchen. You know, if a product didn't come in, what are you going to do with your menu? How are you going to still be able to put things out? If this is if this machine broke down, if you short on these many people to come in, it gets you real world ready. And I'm not sure about any other school, but for me, Washburn was like, you know, the grit of it. And it didn't. Some schools could be kind of fancy smashy about it and make you think that it's all French and la la la. No. Cooking in the kitchen is the most rugged experience you can have if you start off in a rug. That's like having a bad car first, you know. If you drive a car that's bad, it's nothing, because if your car, if you have to get another bad car, you already know what to do.
Right.
Working, and I've, you know, it's not no surprise. If you're driving a luxury car and then you go to a bad car, you're going to be shell-shocked. But if you already have your experience with a bad car and you get into a luxury car, you appreciate it more. But you know what it's like to be in that bad car. So that's kind of how I took it. That's kind of how they explained it to me when I went into my first class. You know, he's like, this is like your bad car. You're going to get into a luxury car eventually, but this is your bad car. Learn how to take care of it. And I've kept that with me through my culinary endeavors also.
Awesome. Awesome. Okay. So if... No, let me ask you this. Did your family support your decision?
Absolutely. The minute I told my mom and my dad that, you know, I wanted to become a chef, again, when I was young, there was not a lot of professional chefs, celebrity-wise, that you could kind of play off of. Now you've got Ramsay, and you've got so many chefs out there that kids are like, oh, I want to be like them. I didn't have that. The only chef I knew about was Julia Childs. And my then, she was old when I started watching her on TV. So when I told them that I wanted to become a a cook, a chef, I think their eyes kind of got wide, like, what? I don't think that was really considered a real thing to them at first. But once I started to get into it and they started seeing the portfolio, because when I was in school, we had to build a portfolio of all the dishes that we made, and they started to see the talent that was coming out of me. That's like, okay, this is not, it is a real thing, but this is a real thing for her. So they started to support me more and more in it, to the point where, you know, my dad was like, okay, now we're going to open up a Caribbean restaurant. Not with me, because I don't know. I didn't know that going into culinary, I didn't know there were so many variations and styles of cooking, which led me to believe that I have no preference. I will cook it all, because just being in the kitchen, being in the mix of it is all that matters to me. I don't have to say, oh, I only do French, I only do Mediterranean, I only do Greek. I'll do whatever is put in front of me, whatever challenge, whatever dish someone wants to put into their belly, I'm going to cook it and I'm going to produce it for them. So my family started to see that she just wants to be in the kitchen. And once I got out of high school and went into college, and then they saw how great I was doing in college, and then I went to go and get my BA, it was a huge support behind that, especially from my dad, because they're more food-oriented than anybody on my American side. So that side really supported me. And I said I didn't get my American support, but the Caribbean side, they're all about the food. And if you want to make it your life, then they totally supported me on that.
Oh, cool. Very cool. Do you let a lot of people call you chef? What does that title mean to you? I know for me coming up, it was many years before I would answer to that. You know, I was just, you know, my name. And other people would be like, oh, chef. And I'd be like, who are you talking to? Because I felt like I had to earn that. And I hadn't quite had enough years under my belt to be comfortable with that. Or is your experience any different?
Actually, no. I felt the same way. My culinary chef scared me into be calling chef. And they was like, you've got to earn your bones. You've got to have done this. You've got to have done that. And I was like, wow, I'm just a cook. People are like, oh, you're a chef. No, I'm a cook. You know, because I felt like I hadn't quite earned my stripes to be called a chef. And I don't know at what point I started to accept being called chef. No, I do, actually. When an actual bona fide chef themselves called me chef, that's when I felt like, okay, I can be called a chef now. A chef who had been cooking for over 40 years, and I had interned with. And he saw my potential, and I worked with him. And he was like, okay, chef, let's go. And I'm like, who is you calling me?
Exactly.
You know, because I know I'm a cook. He was like, no, you're a chef. You know, it takes more than knowing how to make a dish. You're showing heart. That's what makes a chef, heart.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I see the heart that you're putting into this. So now you've earned the right to be called chef. Oh, I almost cried. I'm like, yay. You know, because you want to be called it, but you don't want to label yourself. You know, and even now,
yeah.
You know, with the people in an environment that I work with, I really don't, I would prefer if they just call me Franco rather than Chef Franco, because I'm Franco first. So Franco's going to cook for you, you know, and Franco's going to make sure you eat, and Franco's going to, you know, get the joy out of you tasting the food. The chef part comes when I'm in a more professional environment, when I'm, you know, maybe in a competition or something. But other than that, I'm just Franco. I'm Franco's cooking. And even when people do call me chef, it still has a little bit of awkwardness to it, because you got so used to being a cook for so long that that transition to chef still feels kind of weird.
Okay. Yeah. For me, when people outside of the industry call me chef, I'm much more comfortable with it, because that's all they see, and they don't really know what it means, so I don't take it as you know, a pat on the back or an insult or anything. I don't take it anyway, and I'm like, okay, that's no problem. So especially the kids that we deal with. When they call me chef, I'm perfectly okay with it. But when I'm on a regular job, you know, and I'm next to this guy that, you know, started at the Palmer House 45 years ago, I'm going to let him call me whatever he's comfortable with because I'm not in his ballpark. And so, until I become that elder in the kitchen, it's a little hard for me to take from certain people.
Yeah, you know, I've been in you know, a situation. I'd be like, just call me Franco. You do not have to call me chef. But, you know, because, like you said, where we work and the people that we deal with, the children and stuff, they're going to call us chef because we're in the kitchen and we're the ones cooking. So it's a title that they know to call. But if I'm in the kitchen with someone who's been doing this since they could walk, oh, no, I'm not the chef in here. You are. So I you know, gracefully bow down to that trade-off in a minute. You know, when I get 30, 40 years under my belt, then I might feel a little bit more comfortable with it.
I don't know. I've been in 25 years, and still some people can humble me really quickly. Really.
Yeah.
We've gone over a lot of stuff about cooking in general, and I'm assuming that's your favorite part of being a chef. What's your least favorite part of being a chef?
My least favorite part is arrogance.
Okay.
People who can have arrogance in the kitchen. Coming up on, I'm sorry, excuse me, I just sneezed. Coming up on this generation and how cooking has been glamorized on television. People are not having heart in it anymore. They're seeing the fame in it.
Okay.
And when I go into a kitchen, and I've had this happen many times, and I'm there with someone who may have went to, let's say, the Art Institute or, you know, a more well-rounded school than I. And okay. They feel that they've got more common knowledge about the industry than me. Well, you just graduated 3 years ago. I've graduated almost 10 years ago. I've been in the thick of it. This is your third time. So your arrogance level is really, really high. You've got something to prove. I get that. But you're going about it the wrong way. Disrespect in the kitchen does not prove anything. Trying to be the big man does not prove anything. Because you can have all the knowledge in the world and your food tastes like crap.
Oh, that's absolutely true.
If you have no heart behind the product that you're putting out that people are paying for, that they're sitting there anxiously waiting for to be prepared and brought to their table, they can see that. I believe emotions come out in food. If you're angry, your food is not going to taste well. Mm-hmm. If you're arrogant, your food's not going to taste well. If you're cocky, if you all those things, your food's not going to taste well. If you have heart and love, consideration, humbleness behind your dish, the food is going to be phenomenal, and it can be something very simple. So for me, if I'm going into a kitchen and there's cockiness and there's arrogance, I shut it down as soon as possible because I let them know I'm not in competition. My competition days are over. I'm here to do a passion.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not here to compete. Go compete out there with those who are willing to compete with you. Because if you compete with me and you fail, then I got to deal with another set of attitude. Let's just get the job done. Other than that, I cannot deal with cockiness in the kitchen. It's just, it's that bitterness to the dish that you just don't want, that nobody wants to taste.
Yes, exactly. I've been finding lately that speaking to professionals in other fields, that they don't have a whole lot of reverence for the title chef. I could be in a room full of, you know, pre-med or doctors or architects. It doesn't really matter. And someone would say, oh, what do you do for a living? And I'll say, well, I'm a you know, professional pastry chef. And sometimes it's that sigh of, oh, you know, like, you're beneath me. And you can just see them, like, you roll their eyes either actually or, like, mentally roll their eyes. Oh, she's a great person, you know, that kind of thing. But when I talk to them further, depending on how I feel about the day, because if I don't care that you don't, if I'm not vested in whether or not you accept what I do or not, then I may not say anything at all. But on occasion, I've gone back to those same people and be like, well, you do realize that the title chef, the profession that I'm in, we are basically using applied chemistry and art on top of that in order to produce these things that you're willing to pay $100 a plate for.
Mm-hmm. And math and physics. And we're using every variable out there to make a dish, to make a simple dish. Because
dang, you're right. I'm like, yeah, you remember those classes you were fighting with and you couldn't get it to work? Remember that? Well, that's what I do every day. And they're like, oh.
Exactly.
So it's kind of funny. You know.
And that whole thing, like, when people say, oh, I can't cook for nothing, that's not something to gloat about. Because if you couldn't cook, if you couldn't boil a pot of water, something that's supposed to be simple, you can't look at me like what I'm doing, which is boiling a pot of water, as something that's not simple. Because it takes a lot. If you walk away, you can burn that pot of water. Pot of water can boil. Burn. Mm-hmm. How? Because it evaporates. If you don't put your product and get it done when you're supposed to in a timely fashion, then everything is thrown off. So I've been in that situation, too, when I tell people, oh, yeah, I'm a chef. And they're like, oh, so you cook this and you cook that. And no, it's not just about cooking. No, because if you're baking, baking is like what I call a Hail Mary. Sometimes you get it right, sometimes you don't. And I remember my pastry chef telling me that baking, if you don't, I learned that you have to read your recipes first, because it's that one variable, baking powder, baking soda. If you don't know the difference between the two or what you're doing, you'll mess up the entire thing.
Mm-hmm.
And to start over in bacon is a huge deal. So
yeah,
I tend to be more.
Once your formula is in a pan and in the oven, there's no going back on pastry.
There's no going back.
There's no going back.
It's in there. And you have to, you know, make sure, even with just plain cooking regular dishes, you have to make sure, hey, what's the temperature of the oil? Was this going to be too hot? Oh, that can't have liquid on it, because once I put it into the fire pan, I'm going to start a grease fire. There's so much to it. And I'll tell them, well, go home and try to make this, and let's see how well yours come out versus mine. Because I'm applying all of the knowledge that you don't use on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's, you know, it's kind of, they do downplay the chef thing, you know, cooking. If they're a doctor, if they're, you know, and something they considered, I may not be out there saving lives, but you got to eat to live. So
Somehow,
I'm helping people live by feeding them.
Absolutely. It's somewhere in, mentally for the average American, it's somewhere in between being a high school dropout and being a professional. And you kind of look at them like, how do you think that we've got the wherewithal to charge exorbitant prices for a nouvelle cuisine and all these other things that you run to as a professional because you have the money to do those things, and you think nothing about it. You think nothing about going to the signature room or, you know, any of the high-end hotels that have, you know, restaurant outlets, and you shell out big money, but you don't think 2 seconds about the chef that made it for you.
And all that it took.
Yeah.
All that it took. You can walk around and do rounds and not see one patient all day.
Right.
Where we're in the kitchen, we're there at 6 o'clock in the morning for an event that doesn't start until 6 o'clock at night.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't. And you're on your feet the entire time.
Yeah. Yeah. I've had relatives and just associates or friends of friends totally don't get it. So when I say something like, oh, yeah, you know, currently I'm working for Chicago Bears, which was, I think, about 7 or 8 years ago that I did that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they watched the football game on TV. Football game's 3.5 to 4 hours. Well, that's fine. for the players, but my day on game day is a 14-hour shift.
Exactly.
And they're like, what? You know, whatever, that can't be. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I'm like, and all the security measures you went through to get to your seat, I had to go through all of those, then go down into restricted areas where the kitchen is. Then I had to deal with all the, you know, personnel, all the wait staff, all the bartenders, all of them, get everything rolling and do my job. Yeah, and they're like, what? You know, yeah, it took 8.5 hours to set it up, 4 hours of game time, which is delivery and customer service and all those kind of things, and then probably 2 hours of teardown. So, yeah.
Yep.
And they're just so.
If people have no idea.
Right. You just go to work. It's just, what, 8 hours of your life? No.
No.
Not at all.
No. You know. People don't get it, but.
No, they totally don't get it. So upcoming, one of the big things in the restaurant biz in the next few weeks is Restaurant Week. And it's always situated in the slow period of the year, which is January, February. Everybody's broke after Christmas, and there's nothing really to do until Valentine's Day and then Easter. That seems to be the pattern. So they instituted Restaurant Week, and a lot of different locations are participating, and they have, you know, sampling plates or a special deal on a dinner for two. I've gone and I've done them. Are you planning on doing a little preview on a new location for Restaurant Week?
With my new location that I'm going to start working at?
No, I mean, like, you know, you read over the list of who's offering what for Restaurant Week, what discounts, and da-da-da-da.
I haven't been to Restaurant Week in about 3 years.
Okay.
And every time I plan to go, something happens. I would really love to go this year. I know that GFS had one last year that I didn't get a chance to go to. And my Chef Wendy went, and she said it was really, really great. I know that the one in McCormick Place, I used to go there a lot up until 3 years ago. I'm really going to try to go this year. Me and a chef friend of mine, me and her used to go a lot. I like to see what's up and coming. It's always interesting to see what's the new thing out there that makes restaurant life, quote-unquote, easier. You know, because they come out with these new things and techniques that's supposed to make kitchen life easier. And no matter what you bring into the kitchen, you always go back to the old school way, especially if you came up in the old school way. So I go there just to look around like, oh, okay, so you're using that stuff now. Okay, cool. You know, but, yeah, I'm definitely going to try to get out there this year.
Awesome. Yeah, we have. We have a good convention life here in Chicago, and you know, the NRA show is really good. The houseware show is really, really good. And surprisingly enough, when consumer electronics comes in, there's quite a bit of, I'd say about 10 to maybe about 15-20% of what they premiere at consumer electronics actually are things that input and impact restaurants, and it's really kind of cool to check those out as well, because you'll see the new, you know, the new POS stations or a new accounting kind of thing, new online offerings and what have you that really help to quote unquote make our lives a little easier, at least office wise.
Right.
So, seldom do they have anything that makes, you know, the bench any easier.
And
for those of you who aren't in culinary, working on a bench for us means the stand-up food production area as opposed to the office work.
Yeah, it would be nice to get a stool to sit on every now and again, you know, that is kitchenware resistant.
Yeah, but I've always found, not always, I take that back. There's only one chef that I knew that really didn't do a whole lot on the bench. But was a phenomenal executive chef. There's only been one that, you know, never really never really saw him work a bench that I actually respected. Most of the time, I've always found that if you're, especially executive chefs that are younger than me, I always kind of look at you, a little sideways. I respect your position, but I kind of question, like, what really do you know? You're 27 years old. What do you know? And I try not to be disrespectful, but this one chef in particular at Soldier Field was all that. He was this, baby face, 20-some-year-old Hispanic, and he was, the second executive chef. And so part of me was like, yeah, I listen to what you have to tell me. If you give me an order, I'll do it. But what could you possibly know? You're wet behind the ears. And it wasn't until we had a crisis and somebody, the word had spread around, hey, Frank, chef's over there, pitching in. And I'm like, really? Let me go check this out. So everybody was kind of peeping in to see if he could really hold it down. I stopped questioning him when I saw him with eight omelet pans, working them all at the same time, and everything was coming out perfect. I've been at it a long time, and I don't think I could do eight. I could probably do four. But he was killing it. I was like, oh, never mind. Let me go do my work and get out the way before before I get in trouble. I was like, oh, no, be quiet now.
Right, kind of showed you some, and it's okay, to be in that position sometimes where, I think the younger group coming out, it is that question, well, what do you know? I think their performance is a lot higher than ours, whereas the knowledge can be a little bit more, to see, like I say, a lot of them are just seeing what they're expecting it to be what they see on TV, and it is not that. And when they get in the real world, and all of that is blown to bits in their small reality, then they're kind of like, okay, now I really got to step up. And you have some that will step up, and you'd be like, wow, okay, you know what to do. Then you have others just like, what are you doing? But then you're in the position to be like, well, look, you may have the title, but this is what I'm telling you need to do, and trying to offer that word of advice to a younger generation who may have it over us is sometimes hard because, again, cocky comes into play. But, they're very cocky. They're very, steadfast, headstrong in their knowledge because at the end of the day, yes, you got something to prove, but this is product and this is money. So either you're going to take the help or you're going to mess it all up. Because if you mess up a client's money, that's on you. You're the executive chef. Know when to take the risk and know when to humble yourself. You got to do that every time you go into a new environment in a new kitchen,
That's a big thing for young ones where I've seen them be hired onto a new environment. And I think as a girl, and maybe you can speak to this as well, as a girl, I don't always, matter of fact, I very seldom walk into a new environment as a new hire and start pushing my weight around. And it's
No, I don't.
actually, I've developed something that a lot of people either question or don't do at all. When I have a team, I'm put in front of a team of other professions, no matter if I think you're highly trained or not. Most of my quote unquote orders come in a form of a question. I will say to you, hey, do me a favor, can you cover blah, blah, blah? And changing the way I structured my speech on that, and it became a habit, tended to not ruffle feathers as much and somehow convey to them that actually I do care about your opinion as opposed to,
Right.
hey, go over there. Hey, and go over there. You do this, you do this, you do that. And if you're new and you don't have a relationship with these people, they look at you like, who are you talking to? You're just a
Exactly.
girl.
That I can remember, working in an environment, and of course, we both know most of the time you're in the kitchen, If it's 10 employees, you're only the second girl in there.
Yep.
You know, most of the time in the kitchen, you're dealing with men. And having to not come in there with an attitude, but come in there with a strong presence to say, hey, I am not a weak link. I am not a weak lean. And mm-hmm. I can hold my own with the best of the best of you guys. I've had to do that and show them I am not a frail little princess. I'm going to get in this kitchen, and I'm probably going to move faster than you. But I'm not going to show you that until necessary. So when I did have to push my weight around and say, no, if you got issue, if you got complaints, if you got problems, you could come to me with it. It opens their eyes. And it's like, okay, let's see what this girl is about. And when I was moving faster than some of those guys who had been working there for 5 or 6 years, and they're like, whoa, you're fast. I'm like, see, people look at you and they automatically, well, for me, I'm a big girl. I've been big all my life, but I'm not a slow big girl. I get in that kitchen and I'm Speedy Gonzalez. So when I'm in there moving and I got kickers coming out, boom, boom, food is coming, going, I have people saying this and I mean this extra, I'm gone. I'm in this trance and I see nothing but work, product, and pushing it out. And when I'm moving faster than these guys, who should know this like the back of their hands, it's mind-blowing to them. Because yeah. for me, I go into this mold that is like, I don't know. I can't even explain it. And I turn into this whole different person, and I get it done. And I get it done swiftly, correctly, the way it needs to be. Because I think about if I'm sitting out there, if I'm in a restaurant and I'm waiting 45 minutes for a food, or it's taking forever for this to get done, or this coming out, I want to make sure that the first time is the last time. Mm-hmm. And I'm, you know, I've had to, you know, let guys know in the kitchen, no, I'm not the one. May they be black, white, Mexican, I let them know I am not the one, you know, because they're going to try you because you're the female in the kitchen.
Right.
And then don't be the minority female in the kitchen. Oh, you really got to let them know. You know, I was working at the hospital, and not only was I one of three females that actually cooked in the kitchen. Okay. I was the only black girl that cooked in the kitchen. And I worked with Mexican guys, white guys, Asian, every nationality. Mm-hmm. And believe it or not, it was the African guy that I had to put my foot down on. And I had to say, look.
I'm not surprised. There's a cultural thing with African males that were born overseas that come here mm-hmm. either to study or to work. There's a big difference in how they react to us as minority women versus
mm-hmm.
American minority men. There's a totally different reaction.
Totally.
And in fact, of all the guys I've had to work with, I've seldom worked with an African American male cook. Very rarely, but just dealing with at school. Well, I went to Roosevelt University, and they have a large population from across the globe that studied
yep.
there. I got more problems out of them than any other
mm-hmm.
group, and it was always, you don't need to do this. You're so pretty. You should marry a man like me, and you'll never have to work again. And I'm like,
right. yeah. And then when you are in the kitchen and you are side by side with them and you're one up in them, you know, oh, you don't need a man, and oh, you try to be a man. I say, no, I'm trying to pay my bills.
Right, right.
You know, no, oh, I'm
just,
doing
that's
this.
What's wrong with you American women? Oh, that's what's wrong with you. You think you can do everything by yourself. And you're like, no.
And I have to let them, I say, well, guess what, baby? I have a half Caribbean background. I have people from across the water, too. And I'm what they would call the Rihanna crazy Caribbean. I will go there on you. So, no. This is not that. Is that what you thought I was? No. You know, I go into a kitchen very humble. I go in very meek, very mousy. I go in there to only prove my abilities as far as cooking. Now, when you test that, and you disrespect me, something out of crazy chick got to come out. The crazy half black ghetto, half Caribbean girl got to come out. And that's a whole nother Franco that nobody wants to see. But when I show her, best believe everybody take notice. It may be directed at one person, but everybody going to see her so that everybody can understand. So I won't have to do it multiple times. And I'll let you know in the dough right there, this is who I am. This is what I do and do not take. Respect me. I respect you. Disrespect me, and I'm going to blow up the waters. And once they get that part of me, it's like, okay, we're not going to mess with her no more. You know, because now I'm short, so now I got to deal with the tall guys. And no, don't get it twisted, you know. I'm in this because it's that whole song with the man and the female. Anything you can do, I can do better.
Right.
I can
right.
do it better. But I'm not going to come in there flaunting my stuff, showing you I can. When you want to test me, now I got to hurt your feelings. Sorry, you should have just took it for what it was. But now I got to hurt your feelings and make you look crazy and stupid and like you don't know nothing. You know, but those are the tests, those are the tests that us as female chefs have to deal with in the kitchen.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at the chef competitions, like master chefs, I've never seen them pit a man and a woman against each other. It's always a man and a man.
Okay.
Or a woman and a woman.
Let's talk about, now that you mentioned that, and that was one of the things I had in my brain to talk to you about, because we've both dealt with a particular group of young kids who are blessed to have offerings like the Food Network and all this television exposure to the career that we didn't really grow up with. I remember,
right.
I'm a little bit older, I remember like Sunday morning was the day that public television would rerun all the cooking shows that they had during the week. So you get this long block, and I would watch Julia Childs and Jacques Pepin and Frugal Gourmet, and I would spend my, you know, almost the entire day immersed in food television. But now it's everywhere. Every major
everywhere.
Network has 2 and 3 contests, and you got the Food Network 24 hours a day, and you got all these other offerings. And in a big way, that's great, but in another way, I've always seen it, the results of it in new students coming out of culinary college and new people who want to work in the field, that they've been hyper-exposed to that, and their idea of what this really is kind of vastly different. So
I think,
I've also had a negative, I've seen negative impacts in my customers as well. New customers come to me usually by referral. The sculpted cakes and things that I make for them for private events, most of the time I make them out of my home. It's just, you know, a courtesy. It's not really a quote-unquote business. But in talking with them about, well, do you want this on it? Do you want it to look like that? They have an impression that everything that I work with, I just buy it. And you go, You know, the life-size sugar shoes, high-heel shoes for, well, don't you just buy those? I'm like, no, it takes me a week to make one. You know, that's 8 hours, you know, from little bit here, a little bit there. It takes a whole week for that thing to dry, for me to figure out the style, to find all the components. And they're like, oh. And I think that has to do with television. You've got great shows out there like Ace of Cakes or Cake Boss or whatever. But what the viewer doesn't understand is they boil down.
Is that they're doing that a week out.
Right.
And what they're basically seeing is the finishing touches.
Right.
And you're seeing the last bit. So if they pay much attention, they will notice that each scene of that person making that particular thing, they got on different clothes because it's taking them a week to make it.
Exactly. They've taken a week or more of footage and boiled it down to a half an hour show.
Exactly.
Because most of what we do we're not always cracking jokes. We're not always playing around or this, that, and the other. We're not always just working on one project. It's rare that a pastry chef works one project start to finish and then starts the next one. No. We've got 15 projects working in, at different stages, and we got to balance them.
Especially now that people want fondant and decorative and all of that, and, you know, all those components that make the easiest thing is probably a cupcake. But once you want all those components, even now they want, you know, fondant shapings and cutouts on cupcakes. That has to get hard. That's like playing with Play-Doh, letting it sit out dry. But takes it anyway. Then if you got a kitchen that will maintain the dryness for it to dry, I mean, it's crazy. When I did do, you know, I did want it to focus on baking, and I did for a while, and I'd say for about 3 years I did, and I was doing wedding cakes and things like that, and people see the finished product on television. They have no idea that that client on TV just paid $600 for that cake or $800 for that cake. So we have people come to you wanting a five-tier cake with all these levels and designs, and they're talking about $300. You're three out of your mind, because that cake is going to take, and you're doing it by yourself. This is not a full-fledged kitchen. Okay. It's going to take me a week.
Yeah.
And then you want all these flavors, which means that is product I got. So I think TV has glamorized, which is okay. You want it to be glamorized. You want people to have their eyes glued and their ears open. But they need to have a show that shows people from beginning to finish how long it takes, how hard it is in the kitchen, not how fun, not Chef Ramsay, because you don't get a lot of chefs like that. You may come across a few, but not every chef is like Chef Ramsay. I think if there were more shows that showed what it's truly like in the kitchen, not a competition, not glamorization, none of that, not scripted, but to go into a kitchen at the Palmer House so they can see how long it takes to prepare for a wedding of 300 people with a cake and all these courses. If they shown how hard people work, they would get the reality, like the true reality, not reality TV, but true reality of what it is in the kitchen.
Yeah. I always say that a lot of clients come with Kool-Aid money and champagne dreams.
Exactly.
And those things don't come together because they don't know. Or
they don't.
You know, I'm quick to turn, you know, I won't say quick, but I have no problem telling a client, especially a new one, well, if that's what you want to do, ask somebody else to do it. I have no problem turning down your project because you want my cake for a Sam's Club cake price or
exactly.
a Walmart cake. And I'm like, I can't do it for that. And also my timing is very different. I request 14 days notice on a project because depending on what you're asking me to do, I might have to ship in stuff. And then if the UPS or the FedEx guy misses me at home on Tuesday, then I got to scramble around and figure out where my box went. And
exactly.
I got to have that buffer of space and time. And I've got to be able to wrap my head around it because, you know, I do have other things to do. I'm not just sitting waiting for a phone call and all I do is the cake. No. So all of those things come into play, and it's rare that you get a client that thoroughly understands what you do.
Yeah. Yeah.
But at the same time, my repeat business clients, they don't understand exactly what I do, but they respect the craft to the point of I had a client tell me yesterday, she's part of a family of ladies, and the first customer in that family came to me many years ago, and she always always order stuff in January, the kids' birthdays. She calls me. I pretty much know her entire birthday schedule. And then a sister joined, then a cousin, and I've got them all. And when she picked up yesterday, she says, yeah, I was talking to my cousin. She picked up from you last week. I'm like, yeah. She was like, we'll never cheat on you. Your product is perfect. And I'm like, oh, my God, I should have. She's like, we calling you. You know when, nope, it's you. We ain't want nobody else. Okay. And I'm like, cool. Very cool. I love to be appreciated for it and stuff like that. But then at the same time, you got people who literally think a half a sheet cake with Elmo on it should be $20. And you're like, no. That doesn't,
because if they walk into Jewel's and you get a blank sheet cake with nothing on it, no Elmo, just a couple of balloons, happy birthday, you're paying $30, period.
Right, right.
Now, if you want all this other Elmo and this and that, you have to pay extra for that because that's time. At the end of the day, you're paying for time because that's time away from family. That's time away from things that I want to do to get you what you want for you to pay me $20. I don't think so.
Right.
So for me, going out, the baking became very frustrating because I had did a family member's wedding cake, four-tier, red velvet, one layer, chiffon, lemon, another layer, all back and forth, four-tier for their wedding, and he gave me $100. And I felt like, wow, had you went to a bakery for this cake, you would have been paying $400, $100 a tier. Then I did another young lady's cake, and you know, she wanted all these different levels and different shapes. And I'm like, okay, that's going to run you about $400. Well, I was looking to pay less, but you're going to get less. So for me, I love decorating the cakes. I will probably, like, do that in someone else's bakery and let them deal with the pricing. But I couldn't deal with the customers and how you want what you see, but you don't want to pay. That was very frustrating. And I'm like, I'd rather just cook and feed people. And, you know, maybe later I'll do some cupcakes every now and again for a birthday or a little party or something. But,
yeah, and
you know,
I've seen it with food, catered events. You know, I've had people ask me, and with my current situation, I'll either subcontract it through an off-premise caterer that I do a lot of business with, or I will keep it, if it's something under like 40, 50 people, I may do it depending on the menu and my relationship with the client. But even with that, you know, you want a Sunday breakfast buffet and I quote you a price at $11 per person. And I've had people tell me that's too much. And I go, well, where else in town are you going to get that? You couldn't go sit in a restaurant on Sunday morning and pay less than that, let alone have it delivered to your house. I'm like, you want me to work for McDonald's prices? Get you a big breakfast at McDonald's, stack them up in a thing through the drive-thru, and take them to your guests because that's what you're willing to pay for.
Yep. You know, even if you go to a buffet, you're paying $12 for breakfast.
Easily. And then,
and you're
not
questioning that.
Well, yeah, and you're also not questioning the items. Like, you're not determining what items are in that. And,
right.
Well, I want
at least you can build your own menu for $11 a person. You know, and I, you know what? It's that thing. We go into a restaurant, we go into these environments, and we know everything it takes to get it done. So for us, it's not ostentatious and outrageous. But for anybody who don't know, who has not even seen a blink of how much it takes, it's a problem.
Yeah.
And you have to, and I think that's what all professions is. If you have someone to make you a dress and you want it for this much and it takes this much, that's for any profession that is unknown to someone who's seeking out that that person's need, you know, their product. So I have to, you just have to nicely as possible explain to them. You go anywhere else, if you go out there to a chain restaurant, you're going to be paying more.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to tip the person.
Right.
Versus
right.
This is what you're getting, and this is what you get based upon what you want. So there's a lot of preconceived notions when it comes to our profession. You know, they think, oh, food is so easy, and it's, you know, if it's so easy, why are you asking me to do it?
Right. Or, you know, I could do it for cheaper than that. Then go ahead and do it for yourself. Go ahead.
Yeah. You know, and let me know how that turns out for you.
Right, because chicken is still 69 cents a pound or whatever it is that week, regardless of who buys it. So I don't know how you can do it any cheaper.
Right, and while you're spending time, and you gotta get planning your event, you gotta take the
Yep.
time to go and fry that chicken, wash that
Let's talk
chicken.
about 5 hours worth of shopping.
Exactly. Shop for all of that, and you're still trying to get ready for your event. So, you try your best to explain it to people. Either they get it or they don't. And I'm gonna take it or leave it person. You can take it, you can leave it, but there will be somebody right behind you.
Yes, definitely.
It's such a
So,
fickle field.
it can be. The perception is a little skewed for some reason, and I don't really know if Food Network is helping. I don't know if Rachel Ray is helping understand what we do.
Yeah,
And there's
because
a
it's for them, it's about they've got somebody in the back prepping up everything that they need.
Yeah,
Which is
absolutely.
why
They're
they dish can be done in 30 minutes.
right. They've got 12 chefs on staff, regardless, for every show. And these people are really, in the background doing the hard work. And
It's
so,
funny. It's
it
very
can get a
funny. And I
little.
just kind of laugh it off. And I go about my way. I usually walk away from them, or I'd be like, oh, okay, well, sorry I couldn't help you. And I cut it off then and there and let them go out there and explore their options. And then they see the reality of what it is. And by that time, I've taken on another project and say, well, I can't help you.
Right, I'm booked,
This is not a
sir.
waiting game. This is
Yeah, I'll
not the
even
waiting
tell them I'm
game.
booked for that week, even if I'm not, because the headache sometimes is not worth the.
Right, because I had a headache on pricing, and just I know as a customer you're gonna make me want to kill you, and I'm not a violent person, so we're just gonna just save ourselves the trouble, and you go and find someone that you can work with, and I continue to do the work that I do. So yeah, these shows definitely, it's with them, it's the end product and not the beginning and the middle. It's the happy ending, and if they show more of the beginning and the middle, people will have a better respect. Because I don't think they respect our field. They think cooking is so easy. My motto is, oh no, being a doctor is not easy. I'm not going to go out there and pretend like I'm a doctor. I'm not going to go out there and tell a doctor where I think you should do it like this, and I only want this done. No, because their beginning and their middle was very hard. The end is diagnosing and taking care of the patient. So you can't go and tell me or perceive that you know how something's going to go because you've only seen the ending.
Right.
It's
Right.
unfair,
Right.
but you just, it's, unless these stations and these networks start changing and scripting a profession that is, that even goes if they do one for doctors or architects or lawyers, if they stop scripting it and letting them know that it takes hours upon hours upon hours of working, focusing, planning, preparation, then people will continue to come out into the world approaching professional like ourselves with the notion that at a blink of an eye, like little genie, that this stuff is going to be ready. I hope in the very near future that they change that outlook because it's not fair. It doesn't do us justice, and it doesn't help the field grow for the upcoming generation because they have such a skewed perception.
The next upcoming generation, it is my opinion that because of a lot of food television and circumvent slamming right into the for-profit college model that is now collapsing, that we were, I was personally experiencing interns or new hires fresh out of culinary college that may or may not be prepared for the reality of work. And I think that the ones that I've seen, I work with kids from the French pastry school, from the Cordon Bleu, from our institute, from Robert Morris, and Kendall College. Those are the ones that I've seen. They're in state Illinois. And a lot of them are coming out with this quote unquote education, but did not have the persona of a chef on multiple levels. Like, I've had one young lady who could barely talk above a whisper. And you go, you want to do what? Like, seriously, you want to command a brigade of chefs that are all older than you and mostly male? And you want to talk like Minnie Mouse? Like, I don't
know.
I totally didn't get the connection. And it just
You really have to find your voice in more ways than one.
More ways than one, absolutely.
You can't have a mousy disposition. You've got to, and it's not about being mean. It's not about having an attitude. But it's about letting them know and recognize that you can hold your own. You can't, and if you're in the kitchen where most of them are men, you better come with the thunder and let yourself
right.
be heard. And I've never done it with an attitude. I know how to project my voice to whereas I'm going to command everyone in there to listen. And this is what needs to be done. And I tell them, you respect me, I respect you, we're going to get it done. I'm going to be there. If you need help, let me know. I'm not going to sit back and watch you struggle. We are a team. That's when you get the yes, chef, because they recognize that this is how it needs to work. This is the clockwork, the time frame that we're on. Again, it's all glamorized television. So you just go in there, you hold your head down, you flip a few pans, you stir a few pots, and you're done. There's yelling. There's screaming. There's noise
and alcohol and all the impacts of any HR department that has to deal with new hires that may have a substance abuse or an attendance problem or a bad attitude because they're burned out on this job and they're looking for the next opportunity. All of those things that any human resources department deals with top to bottom is present in any decent sized kitchen. So you've got to learn how to do all of that because most of the time we don't have a human resource department unless we're working for a big corporation. You've got to deal with command roles. And I just kind of think that the for-profit college module that's been out for the last 10 or 12 years, we're so focused on profit that it really didn't matter to them whether or not you as an individual will ever be a chef or ever actually work in the field. It was more about, will your financial aid clear?
Yep.
And if your loans come in and or a combination of loans and checks, if you could pay for it, they'd put you through it. And I don't think it was a good service to the industry, to the individuals at all. And the pricing on some of these programs were three and four times more than I paid for my associate.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
What are you paying for? Like, you know, okay, you went to the French pastry school. Well, I went to a no-name culinary college, which actually is now closed. But I hit the ground floor. I would start at a job. They would recognize what skill I already have. And then experienced chefs would add to my skill base. But like, let me show you this. These kids are coming out, and they're like, oh, well, you know, I went to CIA. And they got this big chip on their shoulder, and they don't know any more than I did coming out of college.
No, no. And that's for me, is the funny part. You know, we went to the rough and tough schools.
Yeah.
We went to the schools that – you know, Washburn, I don't know if it was, you know, well-recognized. But going up, I went to visit every single culinary program that was offered. I went to Lexington to check them out, Kendall, Triton. You know, I went to those, and I'm like, Lexington was on one of my top lists. But when I saw how great my chef, Mr. Martin was, he was phenomenal, and I loved him. And I'm like, I want to be like him. I want to institute – I'm sorry, my kids.
Oh, that's okay.
they just gave me a Valentine's Day card. Y'all are silly.
It's so cute. I love you, by the way.
They just made them in the back. This is what they do when I'm not around. Thank you, sweetie. Thank you, Raya. I think that if the schools went back to that format and gave, it's beautiful. Thank you. Mommy will be in the back in a second, okay? If they went back to that format and showed them, no, this is what it's like. You don't have people. You may have to go in there and think that you're cooking this one day and you're on the prep team. You're going there one day and you're on this team. You may think that you're on the fry on the grill team and you're on a different team. You know, those unexpecteds, they were not brought up on the unexpected.
No.
And we
were all told, you know, it seemed to me like they were all told or at least got the idea that they're graduating culinary school on Wednesday and the following Monday they're going to be in charge of a brigade.
No.
And you go, really? Like, so all these guys with 20, 30, 40 years experience, they're going to listen to you. Why?
Exactly. No, they're not. And it took, and I think you could even agree, it took a long time before anybody saw your talent and was like, you know what? I'm going to put you over here.
Yeah.
Even in the smallest environments. Because there's one thing you cannot do is put out bad product. You may feel like you're ready. And we both came across students
but
and people who felt
ready.
Like they were ready, but you're not ready.
No,
you have no idea.
Man. Yeah, Kevin Hart needs to step in. You're not ready. Don't
you're not me. Ready. No, you're not. And it's great to feel like you're ready, but given the chance, how would you feel if you failed? Be prepared to fail because you're going to fail.
Yeah.
You know, I failed. I'm sure you failed. You're going to fail. Are you prepared to fail?
Yes.
Every profession has a failing point. Are
Absolutely.
You prepared to fail?
Right.
If you're not prepared to fail, then you're not going to make it in this industry.
No, not at all. I just asked a student that really, really wants to be in the culinary career. Okay, cool. I asked them, okay, you're still in high school and you got a ways to go. And you want this and you want that and you want to achieve this high level of greatness. My question to the kid was, I said, okay, I've been in this industry over 20 years. My goal from practically day one was ownership. I want to be an entrepreneur in this field. And because of multiple, you know, impacts on my career path, it has yet to happen. So my question was, can you still say to yourself, 20 years from now, if you have not achieved your goals and things like that, are you still going to strive? Is that something that you're going to look at and say, I'm still going to do this? Or would it break you to have done something for 20 years chasing after a goal that might not happen? If that's
exactly.
What you want, how do you deal with 20 years of not realizing your end goal?
Yeah, I think for myself when I started out, and I know exactly the question that you presented to the youth, and I went through that. When I came in this industry, my mind was I wanted a restaurant. I wanted a few restaurants. But as I got more and more into this field, working for people who had restaurants and then working in a kitchen, I'm like, there's so many variables that I did not even
consider or even thought was possible.
Nothing. Exactly. And then I slowly started to pull away from wanting to have a restaurant. And then I told myself, I don't know how I got geared into the more, because I did the professional kitchens, the hotels and stuff. I think it was after I had my oldest daughter, I went to work in an environment where it was seniors. And
okay.
I started cooking for seniors. What really got me into is that my grandmother had heart surgery, and she couldn't eat the same way. So I was going through cooking school as she was having heart surgery and having to alter all of the favorite foods that she liked for a more healthier lifestyle struck something in me. Like, I didn't even know that could be quite possible. So that interests me. Then I started working cooking for seniors, which it shows you how you can still have every single thing you love and not have to use salt, not have to use this and that. And it
hot
can still taste
pork
great.
And, you know,
exactly.
The nitrates and the preservatives.
Exactly. And I was just starting to be more intrigued with it. So I've applied for places when I was transitioning to different experiences. Then I wind up at the hospital. And then I wind up at my last employer. Now I'm going to another. And this all has diet restrictions based upon a person's needs. And that young girl who started out, 16, 17 years ago, so eager to have her own restaurant, is now more interested in the healthcare part.
Okay.
So if kids knew the transition that you take, like a youth that we both know who's so set on having a Michelin star and 50 restaurants, he hasn't even broken the mold. But once he gets in there, he's going to start off with that Michelin star heart. But something, somewhere in his culinary experience is going to transition him to where there may not even be a focus anymore.
Right.
I think what should be set for them is being the best soon-to-be chef as possible and let everything else find its way to you. Because the healthcare cooking part found me. I didn't find it. It found me. Now I could have went and went to the French and went to this, and I can still do that. But my feet is most planted doing the healthcare part, just like your feet is most planted doing the pastry part. And at the beginning, we both probably had these different perceptions of what the whole cooking industry was about until something came in a turnabout somewhere in that middle. That left we were supposed to take turned into a right, because you looked at that left and it just didn't feel good, and that right felt more comfortable, and your body and your spirit was pulling you that way. So I think if kids had more insight that wants to be in this field, that you may start off saying, I want to be a French chef, and you might end up being a
nutritionist.
Chef.
Or right, and that's
you know, or an assistant. Or are you happy with that? Can you be content with your ending? And I had to tell a young man, I started out with the same ambition, but I could truly say I am so content with where I am professionally in my field that I have no regrets. Don't have no regrets on what you didn't do. Because if it's still pulling you that way, then go do it. Don't do it because it's the right thing to do. Do it because your heart is telling you to make that turn. Don't do it because it's the path you're supposed to follow. There's no path to follow in anything that you do. It's the path that you make.
Right.
So if kids got more insight on that, then there will be less confusion in each field, any professional field. They have more insight. A doctor could be a general doctor, or they could be a plastic surgeon, or they could be a pediatrician, or they could be an OB-GYN, or they could be a... It's so many variables than just being a doctor.
Right.
So I try to explain that. You know, even my young ones, you know, my 9-year-old, she's like, Mommy, I want to be a great cook like you. I'm like, you could be a great cook like yourself, not like Mommy, because you're not going to grow up to want to cook the way Mommy cooks. And want to be interested in the different styles of cooking the way Mommy is. So be a great cook like yourself. Not like what you see on TV, not like what people put out here in the public, but like yourself. And if there were more people out here to gear kids into that, I think there would be less confusion.
Oh, I agree. I agree. For me, my older brother's also a chef, but he took to it after I had graduated, so I was in it before he was. And for me, I had no desire whatsoever to do pastry because it's so much harder.
Yes.
And that's unusual for me because most of the time, whatever I'm doing, whether it's the math class or the science class or whatever it is, I tend to seek the hardest part of it to see if I can do it. But in this case, I had worked with some people that could do things, make your head spin, and I was like, so totally not for me. No. And little by little, after about 3, 4, 5 chefs maybe, all said the same thing. They were like, kiddo, I think you need to be in the pastry department. I was like, nah. You know, that couldn't possibly be right. And I was working at McCormick Place for Levy Brothers, and I was the assistant steward, and the steward takes care of all the dishes, all the tables and chairs, the setup. I was talking to housemen and doing their schedules, and I was working for a guy who, the more he figured out I could do, the less he did. And so more and more of that job got laid on my shoulders, and all the executive chefs were getting more and more upset with him. You're getting this salary, and we're not seeing why you deserve the salary. You've got this hourly wage, you know, 20-some-year-old girl doing the hardest part of your job. And so things would go along, and down. The pastry chef kept telling me, you know, you need to just transfer a department to come work for me. You're not going to have that kind of headache that you're currently going. And I was like, well. And eventually I was like, okay, I'm about to be out of a job. This literally got that tight. And I went, okay, transfer me. And from that point on, every chef I worked with was like, yeah, the pastry department is where you need to be. This is what your skill sets are.
Actually. And it's like you were fighting it. It was like, you were fighting against the tide. because I was so in love with doing pastry. I wanted to do wedding cakes and all of that, but for me, it's hard to roll out fondant. My fondant comes out jacked up, and I don't have a semi-steady hand when writing and sizzling, and I kept fighting against the natural state of where I was supposed to be until I got in the kitchen, and I saw how fast I can go and how I can just put the product out there and it come out good and great. You know, I'm a phenomenal short order cook. You know, I'm also great at, you know, mass production. I'm like, okay, so this is where I need to be. I had to kind of concede to the natural state of things and say, this is where I'm supposed to be. Yeah, I don't have to completely stop baking, but maybe it's not where my hand should lay.
Right.
You know, I had to kind of pull my hand back and say, all right, I get you. Okay, the cosmic fairies of professionalism, I don't need to be over here. I need to be over here. So I totally understand that. And, you know, that's why it's so great being in this field, because there's so many branches you can get into, so many different
styles and parts.
Yes.
Culture you can learn just through learning the food and all that kind of different stuff that really can change your life. And one of the biggest draws for me is there is always something else to learn. I can get bored quickly once I master something. I was like, okay, I've done that. But with food, there is no stop. There's no end goal. There's no I've done it all. Never.
Never.
So,
never.
Awesome. If we are running a little long, which is fine, and if I need to, I'll split this into two parts, but I don't think so. But we're going to wrap it up here. You have been great. Of course,
we're
going to be, you know, completely still in touch with each other for many years, I suspect.
Yes.
Really appreciate you coming on here. And once you've got settled in your new job, and maybe we'll talk about that in a later broadcast.
Absolutely. And thank you for having me on. This has been great. I've never done a podcast. I like talking with people in my profession that does different aspects of this profession. So, getting it out there and expressing it so that other people can realize that this is a great place to be if you know where you want to be.
Yeah.
And, you know, you just take it step by step and don't take what you see on the outside, such as the televisions and all of that, the TV shows, and get in there and say, I want to learn everything. Even if you touch on it for a month or two, learn everything. Because you may not realize what you want to do until you've tried it in this field. So So, and I thank you again for letting me do this. This has been really great. And it must be towards the end because now my six-year-old won't leave me alone.
Well, I'll give you back to the six-year-old, and we will talk to you again soon.
Okay. Thank you, Chef Elena.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, bye.